Hello and welcome to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hoger. Thank you, Barry, for being with us today on this Blue Monday. We have to say Blue Monday. A lot of people are sad today, but there's really, well, I won't say there's no reason to be, but, you know, you have to move on. And Patrick Mahomes doesn't seem all that sad. I mean, he wanted to win. He wanted to go to the Super Bowl. But he, of course, knows that he'll have many more chances to do that, and I'm sure he will. It's also Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and some events are going on around the city. As far as we know, here at KKFI, they're still going on. So you might check if you're headed to one of them. But still going on. As far as I know, we're going to talk about some of the things you can see here around town. You know, what better way to get yourself out of the doldrums than to see some good shows around town? And we're going to talk about two of them in the course of the program today. First off, the Kansas City Repertory Theater. They are doing the show Indecent, and it's a story about scandal. We all love scandal. Why is that? Well, there's a part of us that loves to talk about scandal. Here to talk about it are two of the actors from the Kansas City Repertory Theater. Alexander Savronsky is with us as well. He is a composer. He is the musical director of the show. He is a music writer. He's also an actor in the show, Meyer Balsam. He plays the role, and also members of the ensemble. So he probably plays a lot of smaller roles within his role. We'll explain this a little later on in the show. He has appeared on Broadway, off Broadway, and lots of other places as well. All over the country, he told me. So that's what I wrote down. All over the country. And maybe he'll want to touch on that a little bit during the show. This next gentleman, you probably recognize the voice. Boy, if you don't know the voice, you for sure know the face. Victor Rader Wexler is with us. He plays the Elder Otto. And within that, Otto plays other characters, you told me. Is that a fair
refers only to the fact that the play features an acting troupe, and there's a man and a woman who play all the older people. That's why it says elder. There's a man and a woman who play all the people in the prime of their lives, and there's an actor and an actress who play the younger people, the ingenues. So six of us play all the roles, and there's probably 40 roles, I don't know. And then there's a stage manager who's just plays the stage manager.
And in addition, there are three musicians on stage, of which I'm one of them as well, as being the composer music director. And we provide all the music, as well as being able to step in and outside of the world of the play as members of the troupe as well.
So they're in the troupe too.
Yeah, Victor is a well-known face. You've seen him on Broadway, off Broadway, on national tours, on television a lot, regional theater, and Best Actress is a new one for me. Best Actor at the Brussels International Film Festival for the movie John.
How did that come up? Because I've been here with you many times, and you've never picked up that one before.
never saw it on one of your bios before. Victor, of course, is well-known for the sitcoms and things, but he told me one time he loved the theater even more than doing that.
Oh, much more. I'm just came here to Kansas City 11 years ago and slowly got, you know, shucked off any demand there had been for me in television or film, and have settled into theater and mostly here, and it's my favorite part of my life.
Now that you've said that, you'll start getting offers again. Well, it tends to happen.
This show that we're doing right now originated in Washington, D.C., and then from here we'll go to Baltimore, and this is the first chance I've had since I moved here to leave town, because I was raising two kids. But one of them now has graduated from college, and she's in San Diego, and the other one is student teaching this year. This is her last semester. So I got to go out of town for the first time.
Good for you. The name of this show is Indecent. It's about a scandal. You know how we all love scandal? I mean, we say we don't. We kind of look down our nose at that. I don't pay attention to these things, but we do. We're always interested in things like that. What is this show about? Which one of you would like to kick? The storyline of Indecent.
I'm happy to jump on that. It's a really wonderful new play by Paula Vogel, a great, great American playwright. And it tells the story, the true story, of a play that was written in the early 20th century by a Yiddish writer named Sholem Asch. He wrote this play called The God of Vengeance in Yiddish. And it was performed all over Europe, and then eventually in the early 1920s it moved to New York as part of the Yiddish theater scene, and then was translated into English and moved eventually to Broadway. And it was when it moved to Broadway in 1923 that it became quite a scandalous event. The powers that be, so to speak, shut it down. The show was shut down after, I believe, only about 12 performances or so, give or take. I'm not entirely sure. You can check me on that. But it was shut down surely before it was supposed to close, because it featured on stage the first lesbian kiss, and it was considered quite scandalous for its time. And the entire cast and crew were forbidden from performing, and there was a court ruling that actually then set a precedent for how homosexuals would be portrayed on stage in American theater for the next couple decades. And this one little Yiddish play kind of changed the face of American theater, and especially right now in the world that we currently live in, as opposed to any other, I guess. It's a very timely play dealing with issues of foreigners and immigration and different language barriers, LGBTQ issues, censorship, arts, the power of art versus the power of most anything else to bring people together. It's an incredible piece of theater, and it's one that a lot of theaters around the country are doing right now. We are certainly not the only production of the play, but we are very unique in that. And I'll just speak a little bit to my own role in the show in this way. As the composer, it's a very unique opportunity that we have on this production, because every other production of this play it features the original score from the Broadway production from a couple years ago, a brilliant score that was brilliantly written and conceived for that production. And every other production of this play will feature that score. We are the only production that has been allowed to use original music, which I wrote for the show. So it's a very unique experience going to see our production versus any other, because the sounds that you will hear will be unlike any other production that you'll see of this play in the country.
Then toss it.
No, please, go, Victor.
But the reason it happened, to my understanding, is when our people that we're working for got the rights very, very early. And at that time, they said, you can buy the rights to the play, but not to the music. You know, we reserve the rights to the music. So they bought the rights to the play without music and hired Alexander to write a score. Well, later they figured out, wait a minute, nobody, these musicians who that wrote the original score are being cut out of it. So now in their contract, you must use the other music.
Oh, I see.
So as a result, we will be the only ones to use Alexander's wonderful score, which I'm going to toss it back to you.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. It was just a result of the people that are involved in the show being very early on, aggressive in wanting to do the production so early in advance that they actually got in front of it before the composers themselves could
Well, I was going to ask, was this a joint decision to allow this, take this by Paula Vogel and Eric Rosen? Did they decide that, okay, we'll let him do this for this?
Well, I think
version.
It's pretty standard for plays. I mean, I don't know of any other play that features music. I mean, the difference between this and any musical, so to speak, where this is a play with music, is that when you do a musical, the music comes with it as you would the script. Like if you're doing West Side Story, you're doing the score of West Side Story. You're not writing only music to West Side Story, you know, and doing the book. So with plays, it's very common, if not the standard, that when you're doing a play, you also will be hiring a new lighting designer, a new set designer, a new costume designer, a new composer, new actors, new director, that every new production of that play will be reconceived in all the design elements. I think the understanding was that this play would be no different since it is a play. But they decided to market this and kind of license it differently than most plays. Even other plays that I know of which have music, like a play called Peter and the Starcatcher, features a wonderful original score, but even that score is optional. You don't have to use it if you're doing a play, a production of it. You can write your own score or you can use the original. So this is a very unique situation in that the composers have now licensed their music the way you would a musical. But before all that was put into place, because this is a very new process and a very new play, we were able to get kind of right before all that was set in motion. So we have a very unique situation that we're able to write the original music.
I would imagine then you intentionally stayed away from listening to the to the original score,
unfortunately.
So you wouldn't even subconsciously copy anything.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, once I knew I had the job, absolutely. But unfortunately, I'd seen the show twice on Broadway. I think it's an incredible piece of theater. It was also taped for PBS. It's definitely worth watching. It's a brilliant piece of theater. It's a brilliant version of the play. Ours is definitely very different. Their interpretation was very minimalistic. Ours has a fairly large set with a lot of pieces and moving parts, quite literally, in fact, like moving pieces of scenery. So it's a very different interpretation, both visually and in all forms aesthetically, to the original production. And they both tell the same story. I mean, that's kind of the joy of all of these plays, as you can see. You know, I work almost exclusively in Shakespeare, primarily, rather. And, you know, you can do 10 productions of Romeo and Juliet, and every one of them will be completely different. And that's
one of the things that also sets us apart, I think. For example, is he said minimalistic on Broadway, that they just used costume pieces, but we use whole costumes. And our designer, Linda Rothke,
our costume designer, yeah.
For example, the play takes place over 50 years, and she'll take a jacket. And over the 50 years, the lapels get altered. They're all very accurate for their time and place.
Yeah.
So that, and the costume plots.
For massive.
Example, you look at
absolutely
mine.
Massive.
I haven't counted across, but I think when I look at mine, it's about 17 costumes.
Wow. Yeah.
That pop in and out. So, you know, we're very produced.
Including, like, not only coats, but also like shirts and hats and wigs and beards and mustaches, and so it's the conceit of the troupe, the core members of the troupe that Victor explained playing all the different roles, is pretty beautiful in the sense that you actually get to watch these troupe members change into the people that they're portraying quite fully, not only just in terms of our acting abilities to kind of change voice or stature and things like that, but also the physical transformations are pretty drastic. It's pretty cool.
I've asked composers before how you get the motivation. Do you imagine what's going on stage and then use that in your mind to come up with a musical sequence?
No, I actually try to stay far away from my imagination when it comes to starting to conceive something, and I mean that quite seriously. I'm, in addition to being a composer and a musician, I'm also an actor as well, so the joy for me, as many actors would share, is the joy of being in the room and kind of discovering it all with your company, and kind of the same way an actor would maybe read the script and have some ideas of the role, but certainly I would hope at least the actors that I admire, a lot of their process is similar to my own, which is you kind of come in with some ideas, but you don't make any decisions until you're in the room because you don't know what that other half of the equation is going to be. Your other performers, the audience, the director, all these things are going to have an effect on you. The costumes you're wearing, the lighting, the set, all these things will influence the choices you make. So as a composer, I try to walk in with some ideas, some starting places, you know, like what I call a palette. Like kind of the way a painter would assemble the colors they're going to use. They won't have every single color of the rainbow and every single, you know, color known to man available. They'll kind of have, like, this is the color palette I'm going to use for this painting, and then they start from there. And I kind of assemble the sounds I think I'll be painting with, so to speak, and I'll walk in the room with that, and then we figure out how to paint together. And I like to create musically in the room with the actors that when we see a scene happen that I can say, oh, I understand now the moment of tension is over here, and this is where the scene rises into a climax. This is where the tension dissipates. This is where I want to hold the audience's attention. This is where I want to release it, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me color in here, too, to say that Alexander, we haven't mentioned that he's a musician as well. And so in this show, because he plays the piano, the clarinet, the banjo ukulele, the mandolin, the viola, the violin, the kazobo, which is a kind of combination of a kazoo, like an oboe, and he whistles.
That's true. Yeah, there's the three musicians on stage. We all kind of play double and triple and quadruple duty, switching instruments, and so it becomes quite a
when he talks thing. About his palette. I mean, I'm sure that the choice of those instruments was part of.
Yeah, I mean, the play spans, as you said, like 50 years or so. So the musical soundscape, and also not only does it span 50 years, but it spans continents. We start in Warsaw, we move to Berlin, we go to America, then we go back to a ghetto in Poland, I believe, right? In Poland. And then it goes back to America and Connecticut. So, like, as we jump over time and, you know, turning many years into an hourglass, so to speak, the music changes as we travel through time and place.
Yeah, you speak very poetically. I suppose your music is probably that way as well.
I'll let you be the judge.
Interestingly, because it was happening while we were in rehearsal. So the director would often say, "Oh, you know, I want this now to be a happy song." And all of a sudden, we'd come in tomorrow and we'd be given new pages of music, and the number, which had been kind of a torch song, became a happy song. And then later in rehearsal, we said, "That was probably a bad choice. Can we go back to having it?" So we watched the music change on a daily basis during our rehearsal period in D.C. It was quite an education for me. To see it happen.
Yeah, and it seems, I don't think it's too crazy of me to be able to say this now, but it seems that, like, as this production is very popular, not only our production of Decent, but the play itself is very, very popular. Many theaters are doing it. So I know there are some theaters that are interested in having me do not entirely the same work on this, but working on this play at other theaters. And when I do that, I will be using the original Broadway score, which is a completely different process. You know, then it's about making someone else's work that worked for their interpretation of the play now work for your interpretation of the play. And that's a very different process. So we were very unique, and neither one is better or worse. They're just different, you know? And it's no different than an actor being given a script and saying, this is the monologue you're working with, make it happen. And then an actor being given a script and saying, hey, the playwright's in the room. They're going to be rewriting pages with you and making it work for what you need. What do you think? It's an open dialogue. So actors, as an actor, I'm used to working with, you know, Shakespeare, where you're not going to be changing primarily any of the words, hopefully.
hopefully, yes.
you know, you may be cutting lines and trimming things for a production, but ultimately that's the text. The playwright's not in the room there to say, well, you know, does that not work for you? Let me give you an alternate version, you know? And then working with a new writer that might be able to rewrite. So as a composer, it's a similar process.
In my New York life, I did a lot of developmental theater, which is what it's called. Used to go off to a place, the O'Neill.
Absolutely. It's still a very vibrant place.
Playwrights Conference. Mm-hmm. And playwrights would come, and we would work on brand new stuff constantly with the playwrights there. And the play would change on a daily basis. So just to what Alexander says. Also, he talked about coming with just a palette. I want to say that this show is on PBS, and I was wanting to watch it, but then I got cast. And so I'm dying to see it, and I hear it's really, really good, afraid if I look at it, I'll try to borrow some brilliant ideas, and the next thing I know, I'll corrupt my own thinking.
It's really outstanding. Aaron Halva and Lisa Gutkin, who wrote the original score, are just unbelievable musicians and gracious human beings, and they actually just are about to, in a few days, I think, on January 25th, if my memory serves, I believe the Indecent cast recording is coming out, that they actually recorded like a full album of the original Broadway company with extended versions of the transition music and of the songs, as opposed to like a 30-second clip for a transition. So the music itself is not only great for the production, but it's good in its own right that they've decided to produce its own album. So it's a quite heavy musical shadow to kind of be writing in front of, so to speak. But it's also I don't find it intimidating any more than I would find intimidating to know that if you're playing Hamlet, to know that some great actors have done it before you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there are certain artists that are intimidated by that kind of a thing.
Like, what's your last name?
Lisa Gutkin. She came and saw our show.
She saw our show and was very approving of it.
So. Yeah, she really, really loved the work.
She wrote the original, the Broadway's.
Yeah, she and I talked for a long time, and she really loved the work that we did.
Yeah.
And our interpretation is very, very different, you know? There's a couple songs where we completely reconceived what... Because it's a different story that we're telling, a different way of telling it. So.
Speaking with Alexander Savronsky, the composer, musical director, and also performer in the show, and with Victor Rader Wexler, also in the show, the Kent City Repertory Theater version of Indecent, which is in previews right now, opens officially, but it's open now. That must be strange. You do previews, you do the show, but then you have an official.
Well, when we're in previews, we can still change. We can still change what we're doing in previews.
But luckily, we've already performed for 5 weeks
in
Washington, D.C. at the Arena
That's
Stage.
True.
So
yeah.
The show is really solid, so I would say for audience members that are thinking about coming for our previews, it's just as good as it will be. It's phenomenal.
Opens officially then on Friday the 25th.
That's
runs
when the
through,
press gets to come.
Yeah. That's when we get judged.
And runs through February the 10th at the Kansas City Community Repertory Theater in the Spencer Theater, 4949 Cherry, on the campus of UMKC. The number to call for more information, 816-235-2700, or online at kcrep.org. Speaking with Alexander and Victor, what was it like in Washington? Is playing Washington or New York different from playing Kansas City?
I think so. I was born in the Midwest, and then in my late teens moved to New York, and I found the cultural change to be so paralyzing to me. It took me years to understand how to function in the East, and going to D.C. was very much an Eastern city.
Sure.
I thought, and the cultures are different, and the audiences are different, so we were just seeing what Kansas City is going to think of it, because from here we go to Baltimore, we'll be back in the East again.
Sure. Yeah.
So we know we were really wildly embraced in Washington, D.C. We were a very, very popular show received all kinds of plaudits and warmth. And we're hoping for the same here, but none of us are sure.
Oh.
I'm more comfortable in. I was born in Toledo,
uh-huh.
So I'm just more comfortable in the Midwest. And after 30 years in New York, I spent 15 years in Hollywood, and that's yet a whole different culture too. So this is going to be a new experience, and probably, and this is the interesting thing, nobody ever credits the audiences for shaping the shows the way they do.
Mm.
Shows move to the audience. You know, whether if there's a candy wrapper or a tear or laughter, all of that changes what happens minutely. But when you're doing it 8 times a week, you move it to the audience, whether people want to or not. So the show when we finish in Kansas City will not be the show that finished in Washington, D.C. In subtle ways, perhaps. You know, the script will be the same, the actors will be the same, the intentions will be the same, but we will have moved. And that's another reason why I love being in theater instead of television or the film, which I did for my Hollywood time. Is because really the editors have such control there. That extra beat while somebody cries can go away, you know. And by the way, this is a play where there's lots of laughter and lots of tears from the audience. And of course we can't help but react to that.
Of course.
Yeah, just naturally. Made me think because of this football game that just happened yesterday.
Yes.
The difference between a home game and an away game. Uh-huh. And the difference is really in the stands, I think. Not in the locker rooms, but...
No.
Not on the diamond, but in the stands.
It's not... after you play Baltimore, does it go elsewhere?
No, that's it. That's
that's it?
It just vanishes into air.
So Washington, Kansas City, and Baltimore. Well, that's probably because of Eric Rose and wanting it to come here.
I think it's a combination of all the different theaters just wanting to
produce
kind of
it
come together. Yeah,
the all three of them theaters. Got together to produce it. I think economically it makes sense.
Yeah, this is not a tour; it's a co-production, meaning each theater gets we don't just come into each new city and just show up at like the local performing arts center and perform the show as it is. We actually, the director and all the designers come with us, and each city we revisit and retweak. So the show is, as Victor said, in constant process, as opposed to a tour that, like, once you open in the first city, you're done, you know?
Sure. Well, that gives you a unique perspective if you
Absolutely.
Choose to go and see the show. It will be on the stage of the Spencer Theater through February the 10th. It's officially opens on Friday the 25th. They don't have shows on Monday, of course. The Actors' Equity Day off. But performances in preview will continue after that. If that's when you would choose to go. The number to call, once again, for more information, 816-235-2700 or online at kcrep.org. Only less than 2 minutes to go. When this tour is over, when this co-production is over, what will you be doing then? You probably have a full schedule.
Right now I'm in talks with a couple of the theaters to do some other work. I'm not fully at liberty to say just yet, but I'll be going home. My wife and I both work in the theater, and she's a brilliant, brilliant props artisan working working at Barrington Stage, where we live in Western Massachusetts. So I'm looking forward to going home and spending some time with her and my dog.
Sure. And what about Victor? Undoubtedly has something.
I'm coming back here, and I'm going to work for Kansas City Actors Theater, where I've interviewed with you before, and we're sure. going to be doing mornings at 7. Uh-huh. And so I'm booked to that. And then that takes me through June, and I'm going to try to lay low for a while. And,
oh, not going to do Shakespeare?
Well, no, nobody's asked me to do this.
I find that hard to believe.
One of the reasons people say, what are you going to do in an actor's life? You do what you're hired to do.
Indeed, sure.
Somebody has to call, you know, I, at least in my life, don't call around saying, you got something for me. I think there are people who do. But I waited for the phone to ring, and I've been lucky for a great part of the career that the phone rings. There's been parts of the career where the phone didn't ring, and I found life was pretty rich anyway.
Yeah,
well said.
It is. Well, thank you both for coming on the show today
and
talking about the Kansas City part of this co-production, Indecent. Alexander Savransky, who wrote the music for this, and this will probably be your only chance to see this particular music version of the show. After that, it reverts back to the lady's original version, and that's kind of sad in a way, Alexander.
I think it's quite joyful. I think the reason I do theater is the impermanence of it. I love the fact that it just kind of just goes away, that you have to catch it when it's alive, and then if you don't, that's it.
And you can't tell somebody, you try sometimes, it was so wonderful, but it doesn't, there's no way to say how wonderful something was. I just saw Cherry Orchard at the Met in town. It was wonderful, but I can't tell you why. You know, Chekhov is wonderful, and they did a good job of it.
Got to be in the room.
Yep, you have to be there then.
So come join us. Come be in the room with us.
Running through February 10th at the Kansas City Repertory Theater. I'll give the number one more time, 816-235-2700, or you can make plans online at kcrep.org. Thanks so much for being with us. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we're going to talk about another show that's opening actually tomorrow night, the Black Repertory Theater of Kansas City. They're doing Looking Over the President's Shoulder, and Damron Russell Armstrong will be here. He'll tell us what presidents and all that Alonzo Fields, chief butler at the White House, had to deal with when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI. 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. The films from writer-director M. Night Shyamalan are always a crapshoot. When he finds his stride, as he did with The Sixth Sense and Signs, his movies create an effective and otherworldly atmosphere. When he loses his grasp, as he did with The Last Airbender and The Happening, it's hard to believe it's the same filmmaker. His latest thriller is Glass, a dark comic book movie that provides the conclusion to a trilogy that also includes Unbreakable from 2000 and 2017's Split. The results are a mixed bag. Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson return from Unbreakable, and James McAvoy reprises his brilliant role as a man with multiple personalities in Split. Shyamalan's complicated plot amounts to a thesis on comic book superhero origins. It requires an inordinate amount of time and dialogue to explain, turning the actors into narrators instead of characters. Even though the movie is overlong, there's really very little real character interaction. While Glass isn't bad, it's just a disappointing conclusion to an ambitious premise that became too convoluted for its own good. For patient viewers, the Korean film Burning offers many rewards. A sure thing for an Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language Film, Burning is both a thriller and an effective character study involving a young man whose girlfriend returns from an African trip with a rich, enigmatic stranger who disrupts their lives. The wealthy stranger is played by Steven Yeun, best known for his role as Glenn Rhee on The Walking Dead. There's a lot going on in this low-key drama that effectively builds tension as our protagonist attempts to solve the mystery of his girlfriend and the secretive stranger who admits to a love of burning down abandoned greenhouses. In Burning, filmmaker Chang-Dong Lee offers an effective slow burn. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. Freeze Frame!
A look back 20 years ago to 1999, featuring music from that year and your reflections as we put your calls on the air. We're going to party like it's 1999. Wednesday morning from 6 to 8.
Hey, and welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. We're going to journey on now and talk about the Black Repertory Theater of Kansas City, where they are doing the production Looking Over the President's Shoulder, the story of one Alonzo Fields, who was the chief butler at the White House. He served under four U.S. presidents. One would be Herbert Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, and Dwight D. Eisenhower. And I served during those times. Damron Russell Armstrong is with us. Yes, Damron was out there talking with Victor. Everybody likes Victor, right?
What's not to love?
Everybody likes Victor. Nice to talk. Of course, he's such a recognizable face.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't mention
and voice.
Well, he was in here, but you saw him on Seinfeld. You saw him on King of Queens.
Yes.
You've seen him. I've seen him on other shows, you know. Once,
and I just saw him in the lobby, which is why we love coming to be on your show, Michael. It's like a family reunion every time one segment ends and another one starts.
Well, thanks. Thanks for saying that. Damron is with us. Damron is very ambitious. He decided to start his own theater. Now, he was working in theater. He worked here. He went to New York. He was very popular in Florida, from what I understand. Very popular down in Florida.
Which I, at this day and age, yes, I'd love to be able to return to Florida. Well, get away from this weather.
On a day like today.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. But you've been, is this your third year now? Yes. Time goes so fast.
I know. You blink and it's the third season, and it's halfway through the third season. This is the third of the four main shows that we're doing as a part of the third season at the Black Repertory Theater of Kansas.
Now, the first two shows, I guess, were at the gym.
Yes.
Yeah. And, but this one is at the Bruce Watkins Cultural Center on Blue Parkway.
Yes. Yeah. We are always looking to do partnerships with folks in town. And this seemed like the perfect connection with Bruce R. Watkins and all of the work and service that he did, and placing this show, of course, during the week of Martin Luther King's birthday.
Sure.
To focus on Alonzo Fields and the work that he did and the sacrifice that he made for the arts by working at the White House.
Yeah, it's working at the White House. Mm-hmm. How did Fields get a job working at the White House?
And this is a real story of the chief butler who worked for all four of those presidents. Interestingly enough, the underlying story is what really drew me to the piece as an artist. He was an opera enthusiast. Well, he was a fledgling opera star. His contemporaries were Marian Anderson. As a matter of fact, he was highly regarded before she was, because of the number of years that he had already been in the business. Well, the Depression came around, and he says this beautiful line in the show, which is, "Art is always the first to go."
Huh.
In any sort of depression situation. And so because that was the case, he then had to find work elsewhere. And so there was an opening for a butler at the White House. So he thought he would come and work at the White House for the winter. And then when auditions were happening in the spring, he would get another job.
And stayed for different presidents, the different
yes.
eras.
He also says in the play,
two Republicans and two Democrats.
He planned to stay for the winter and ended up staying 21 years.
Yeah, that's a long time in a pressure cooker such as that. I don't know much about the Hoovers. I know the Roosevelts had a lot of kids.
Yes,
of various ages.
Huge, huge family, and there's a huge chunk in the show both about Roosevelt and Truman.
Yeah, well, Truman had his wife, his daughter, and for a time his mother-in-law lived there as well.
Yes, so. But the Roosevelt, huge, huge family.
And Eisenhower, I guess all their kids were grown and gone by the time he served in the White House. So that was probably easier. So I'm going to think that working for the Roosevelts was probably the most difficult, but maybe not.
Well, I think it became the most relaxing because the family was so huge. Oh. There was less protocol to follow. So it was like a daycare. Because before that, there was just these series of protocols that were in place that you had to stand as a butler in the room between courses. You always had to be seen and not heard. Things like the scraping of plates or the washing of dishes, all of that didn't happen for the family in that they never heard it or saw it done. But the place is the Roosevelts were so lively that they never heard us scraping plates or washing dishes.
I have read that there was always something going on.
Oh, yeah. Roosevelt and, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt, who never sat down, who always on the go. So.
Yes, always on the go. Very outspoken woman.
Yes.
And broke a lot of ground herself. Oh, yeah. With the things that she did. I don't know much about the Hoovers. He entered serving the Hoovers.
Right. He entered in 31. The presidential election would have been in 32. So he would have only been with them for 9 months. So there's a bit about them at the top of the show. But the bulk of his years, of course, Roosevelt served 12 years.
12 years. Yeah. So yeah, at that time, the longest serving, and I guess will always be, if we follow the Constitution, the longest serving president of all time.
Yes, and since he served for 21 years as the butler, 12 years is half of that.
See, he's round, he's privy to things that most people would not know. In the years after he left the White House, were people after him to write memoirs or disclose secrets?
Well,
or
James Steele, who has close ties and connection to Kansas City, wrote the play, and he did his research from the memoirs of Alonzo Fields. So there's his memoirs, and I believe there's a book as well about him and his insights and into the White House and into the presidents.
I'm not very good at protocol about these things. I'm just not. What is the duties of the chief butler at the White House?
He basically is the man in charge. He does the schedules. He hires extra people for the larger parties. He makes sure folks get paid, basically. And everybody reports to him, and he reports to the chief usher.
I see. See, there's different levels of things.
Yes.
This is all very confusing. So you play him as a man with a lot of responsibilities.
With a lot of responsibilities. I wish the play was linear because it would be easy to follow, but it jumps all over the place until you get into the actual function of him serving each of the presidents. So it's a little much to learn.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
What, in the Truman years, they actually left the White House for a year or two. The entire, and a lot of people don't realize this, the entire interior of the White House was redone.
Right.
For structural reasons at the White House. I understand Margaret was playing the piano, and one of the piano legs actually broke through the floor. Well, that's if you visit the Truman. Grew up in Independence. Uh-huh. So at the Truman Library, they talk of this. So the entire inside of the White House was redone. Now, they followed the plans, the original plans, and rebuilt it as close to being the same as possible. But the interior of the White House today is not 100% what it was before then.
Right, right.
So
right.
What did Fields do during the intervening time that they were not in the White House, Mr. and Mrs. Truman and family?
Well, of course, he was the chief butler. But when they moved across the street to the Blair House, which then became the White House, the place where the president resided, he became maitre d'hotel. The President Truman appointed him that title, thus making him now in charge of most everything. So he was in charge of the 15 butlers, cooks, pantrymen at that time, as well as organizing and planning all the menus and all of the dinners and receptions.
Yeah, that's a big job.
Yeah.
A lot of planning, probably a lot of consulting with first ladies and presidents.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Making these decisions.
Oh, definitely.
Sure, a big job. A lot is expected of you. I guess mistakes are at a minimum. It's probably very difficult and can be very touchy.
Yeah. And we ran into a little snag this weekend with the weather, we lost a day of tech. So right now I'm still over there building the set, even as you hear my voice.
Oh, well, it opens actually tomorrow January 22nd, and runs through February the 3rd at the Bruce Watkins Cultural Heritage Center, 3700 Blue Parkway. If you need to map quest things, you probably drive by it all the time.
Yes, and wonder what's inside that building.
I've seen a few concerts in there, too, over the years. If you need to map quest things, the zip code is 64130. Speaking with Damron Russell Armstrong, who plays the role of Alonzo Fields. And I don't know, do you try as best to put yourself in the skin of Alonzo Fields?
Oh, I think you do that with every part that you undertake, because mostly, especially embodying a man who came up in a different era than I'm used to, took a little research, and James did a wonderful job of penning the script, giving you markers and clues of the very being of this person, the fact that he was an opera enthusiast, and then became the chief butler, tells you something about this man's personality that people picked up on.
Was he there essentially 24/7? And I guess I'm getting to, did he have a family of his own?
Yes.
Did he go home at night?
he was living in Boston and was about to embark on his concert debut in Boston when the man that he was serving at the time, Dr. Samuel W. Stratton, who was the president of MIT, passed away. And so he then was living in Washington, D.C., but had a home in Boston where his wife lived, and would go back and forth, essentially, for the most part. But once he became the chief butler, that was no longer possible, because he would work sometimes months on end and 13-hour days, so that doesn't really allow for much travel.
Well, that's pretty rough.
Yeah.
When the president travels, and they do, at least in these times,
right,
they travel quite a bit. Did he travel also, or did he stay back at the White House?
He stayed at the White House. There's one instance where they talk about the president and the family being in Missouri, and the president flying back from Independence, and he being at home and being surprised when the president said that he was coming back and was having a party that night. And Alonzo had let the staff go for the weekend, so then having to collect them to get ready for the party that very same evening. So, he stayed behind.
Well, knowing Truman, he preferred the train when he could. And so that makes it an even longer journey time-wise.
Yeah, yeah. And under this circumstance, it was the beginning of the Korean War, so there was a flight taken back for this one.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yes. What is there anything about Fields that surprised you? Any little insights? I'm not ruining the play. You still want to see the play. But any special insights about Fields that a normal person like myself wouldn't know?
Just the theme behind this show is, what do you do with the dream deferred?
Oh, sure.
What do you do when you have a passion for something that you're not allowed to do, but you still have passion? Can you put that dream onto something else?
That's hard.
It's a very difficult thing. And as a artist, as a performer, I just stand back and go, wow. How does he maneuver through his life when he knows that this is the one thing that he can do. But I think that's a question that a lot of people, it will ring true with a lot of people in the audience that are not artists, but wanted to do, had dreams to do something else, but still managed to get to this point in their lives not realizing that dream.
Was he able to do more professional singing when he left or even during the years?
There was a party at the White House that he was asked to sing at, and that was it. And he says that was the most exhilarating, exciting experience in his 21 years at the White House.
Well, I'm
so
not,
he let the dream go.
Well, I'm not president, but I would have been, I would have invited him to sing more often. Yeah, once I realized what his background was, I probably would have tweaked his duties. But that's just me.
That's just you, Mike.
That's just. And in some ways, your own life is kind of like that. You've been around. You've done things. I remember when you went to New York.
Yes.
I believe you were here
many years
with
ago.
Theater for Young America, and you said you were leaving to go to New York for a while. I remember that. And then so you played in New York, Arizona, the famous Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey, which a lot of the the lady, she was famous for being on the Dick Van Dyke Show, but she was also a singer, Rosemarie. Yeah, she and several other well-known ladies all played the Paper Mill Playhouse one time, and they got a lot of publicity from that. People wanted to see them because of reputation and past work. So that's a very well-known place.
Oh, yes. People generally refer to it as a stepping stone to Broadway because most of the shows that they either create over there or revamp generally go to Broadway. And the show that I did there was Children of Eden. And there was many hopes that show would go to Broadway. But a little teeny tiny show that people maybe won't know went instead. It's called The Lion King.
Oh, yes. Very much.
Yeah, it's a little small show.
Yeah.
that possessed some of the same elements that we had with puppetry and that sort of thing. Decided to take off and become a runaway hit. So,
well, I'll get back to your show in a second, but you also played, I have to ask this, the Pisa Festival in Guatemala. What was that like?
País? Yeah, País Festival. I think it's every 2 years, well, back then, every 2 years they would invite artists from around the world to perform in this arts festival. And I was chosen as the director of the American entry in the País Festival. And so because it was a music festival, I decided to do a conglomeration of a bunch of different shows, Five Guys Named Mo, Ain't Misbehavin', because they were looking for a jazz theme. And so we put together that show and went to Guatemala.
That's right, yes. But you've played all the local theaters, Unicorn Coterie, Theater for Young America, American Heartland, Living Room, Chestnut Fine Arts, the New Theater, Kansas City Actors Theater. But despite all this, you wanted to start your own, the Black Repertory Theater of Kansas City. I guess you performed at the one in St. Louis, and that helped inspire you to start this?
No, I didn't. I, of course, heard of St. Louis Black Rep because it's been around for, I think it's like 60 years now. It was started by Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis, and my love for the two of them then led me to know that St. Louis Black Rep existed. But it would then take another at least 20, 30 years for the concept for me to come back full circle, that the more we learn about one another, the more we understand and can appreciate one another's contributions. If you don't know my contribution, you can't know the worth that I have to the village, to the community. It was back in the day, growing up, the Great American Melting Pot was a Saturday morning cartoon, and it, on a simple level, this really great theme of if in our community you had vegetables and I have livestock, we both bring something to the table. Mm-hmm. And the more we learn that about each culture that makes up the American melting pot, the more we're drawn to understanding and less separation.
Sure. Of course. Yeah, it's, if you can boil it down to, I think I know what the answer is going to be, the biggest need of the Black Repertory Theater, is it more help, more financial help, well, grants? What would be your biggest wish in that area?
Well, definitely funding, because from funding, then you get the extra hands. We're pretty good about finding volunteers to help us every now and again, but then to put those people in place, the grant writers, the office manager, the production assistants, the technical director, all jobs that are paid positions that are necessary that each show goes off without a flaw, are what we need the most. So, of course, all of that only springs from funding, and we are a not-for-profit, so you can donate directly to the website, brtkc.org. You can also go there to get your tickets for Looking Over the President's Shoulder.
brtkc.org, and the number, the 663 number, is that one I should give out?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know if that was your personal number. You need your rest. You don't want to be bothered by guys calling from a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning. That is 816-663-9966. The show will be running starting tomorrow night, January 22nd, and running through February 3rd. Probably no shows on Monday, I'm guessing.
That's correct. And this schedule is a little different than what we're used to. So this week, it'll run Tuesday through Saturday at 7:30, with a Sunday matinee at 3 p.m. Then we return the following week, Thursday night, through Saturday night, 7:30, and close on February 3rd with the 3 p.m. matinee.
Very good. And you can get that information also at brtkc.org. This time, they're at the Bruce Watkins Cultural Heritage Center, 3700 Blue Parkway. Bruce Watkins, of course. Yes. I guess he was in the funeral business, the Watkins Brothers Chapels. That was their family business. He was a city councilman. And was a
civil rights leader.
Was the first Black man to run for mayor of Kansas City.
Yes.
As well. But it's at his Heritage Center,
yes,
where you'll be, and we're down
through the third.
We're down to just a few minutes. What else do you have planned for this season?
To let folks know that it's, we gave you the telephone number, but the website has all of the information. I'm a little busy directing the play and being in the play.
And in the play.
Check with brtkc.org for any of your questions of location or tickets. It's all there. Next up, we're doing a couple of collaborations for the second half of the season. We're doing a reading with Kip Niven's group, Earth.
Sure.
A one-night-only reading of August Wilson's The Piano Lesson, featuring Walter Coppedge and Nedra Dixon on that. That is the evening of February 3rd. Check Kip Niven's and Earth for details on that. Also, Music Theater KC, used to be Music Theater for Young People, their professional stage. We're doing a collaboration with them of the musical Big River that's coming up in March, and we close our season at Black Rep with the play Honky. A dramedy is what we call it, but taking a comedic look at something, a serious subject. This play centers around a marketing team that puts out an ad that then a young African-American man is killed for his tennis shoes, and the deaths continue on the Caucasian side of the town, which asks the question of what responsibility does marketing have, all while dealing with the issue of how we stand on racial issues.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's how we end the season. That one back at the gym.
Music
theater
for young people. That'll be at their space over at the movie theater complex.
Yes, B&B.
That's right.
Yeah.
I had her on a few weeks ago. She mentioned she was doing this with you.
Yes. Oh, excellent.
And I guess your final show of the season then will be back at the gym.
Yes, at the gym theater.
Yeah, in the historic 18th and Vine District.
Come on.
To be doing a show like that at a historic building like that, that must be...
very exciting.
Very exciting for you, yes.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And very exciting what it means to the historic 18th and Vine District, giving you one more option of things to do down there. A little jazz, amazing food, and live theater.
You'll have a chance to look over the president's shoulder starting tomorrow night through February the 3rd at the Bruce Watkins Cultural Heritage Center, 3700 Blue Parkway. You can go online, brtkc.org, and the number you can call as well, 816-663-9966, to see the Black Repertory Theater of Kansas City production of Looking Over the President's Shoulder, the story of Alonzo Fields, the chief butler at the White House through four U.S. presidents. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks, Michael.
Telling us all about it and your plans for the future.
See you at the theater.
All right. The Jazz Insider is next. Sam Wiseman will be playing some great jazz for you this afternoon. We'll have jazz from 1 to 3, the blues from 3 to 6 right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at the Crossing the Road, I'm Michael Hogue. We'll see you next time.